one of the things that's really promising and fun about silent films is that, you know, sonically, they're a blank canvas. They're
true. Sherlock here for Franklin Matters, Franklin Public Radio, anywhere on the internet, WFPR.FM, here in the local Franklin Mass FM radio dial at 102.9, here in the studio today with one of our producers, Chris Leverone. Chris, good morning.
Good morning, Steve. Happy Monday.
Happy April Fool's Day, no less.
That's right.
So we will fool around a little bit, but we won't go to that extreme because there's no tricks. We're just going to have a conversation.
Sounds good to me.
Okay. And one of the key things that I want to start with is you've got a series of silent movies running at the Historical Museum.
So yes, at the Franklin Historic Museum, I show silent films on Saturday nights. I show the movie and then do a brief Q&A afterwards. I usually bundle some trivia with the movie as well.
Mm-hmm.
It's this parochial knowledge that I have about silent films, a very niche thing. And it's been a real success, I think. We're probably averaging about 25, 30 people. Most of them are regulars that keep coming every week.
Yep.
I was also approached by one of our regular attendees about covering a special event that he's going to be doing at the Universalist Church.
Okay.
So I think that it's been a real success for outreach for our organization. We've been talking a lot as a staff recently about how to improve our outreach as an organization. So in addition to just providing normal videography and radio services, event coverage, etc., we also thought it would be a good idea to go places, show up in person, plug Franklin TV, and also show people how cool we can be as individuals.
And that's a great segue, because that's effectively the second purpose of what we're going to do today, because this will be the first in the radio world of kind of what I'm calling the producer series, because people may have seen you in a number of places, whether at town meetings, town events, sporting events. You're always the guy behind the camera. So let's just start there. Okay, so this actually, and there's not a requirement, although at first when I came, it seemed like anybody who's going to do video had to be named Chris. Because there are at least three.
Yes.
But you're Chris Leverone, so just tell a little bit more about you so that people at some point will say, oh, he's the silent movie guy, but he also...
Yes, I am Chris III at Franklin TV, also known as Levy, per my last name. I started working here in January of 2019. It was very shortly after I turned 25. I graduated from Mass Art with a BFA in Film Studies in 2017, and I had a bit of an early life crisis where I wasn't quite sure if I really wanted to go Hollywood or really pursue videography, which is, you know, an expensive trade.
True.
And I was wondering if I should maybe do other things with my life. But I was working at the movie theater at Gillette Stadium, and I got a good taste of customer service and quote-unquote normal life, and I resolved just before Thanksgiving in 2018, which was shortly before my birthday, that I didn't want to be working at a movie theater when I was 25. So I quit, and naturally I was jobless for a couple of months, and a friend of mine, a real good friend of mine going back to high school, Eamon McCarthy Earls,
yes,
told me that there was a potential opening at Franklin Cable. And my thought at the time was, oh, those guys behind the Acapulcos, right? I did some work with them back when I was in high school, and it wasn't a very robust operation. And he said, no, it's all different now.
Yes.
He said, you should go in and talk to this Pete. So I sent him an email introducing myself, showed him a demo reel, and he told me to come on in. We went into the conference room, and we talked about aesthetics for a good hour or so.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't talk all that much about my qualifications as a professional, whatever. Pete wanted to pick my brain about how opinionated I was about media, what my likes and dislikes were.
Yeah.
And because of that, we hit it off immediately, and I started working part-time for a couple of weeks, before committing to full time. I said, let's do it.
Let's do it.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yep.
Yeah. So there's a couple of connection points, which is cool because this is why we're doing this. So yeah, you were doing film. I got my intro back a little bit earlier in my student days at Assumption College. My work study job was in the media center. So having graduated from the cafeteria, I decided I wanted to get a cleaner job. I went to showing movies at the campus center, which in those days were the big reel-to-reel.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Occasionally the thing would split and you'd have to tape it quickly before the crowd got angry and said, come on, come on. And then, you know, there's many more things that happened before. Now I'm here in the studio, still wanting to learn video,
sure.
but certainly much more comfortable with audio.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, you talk to the staff around here and we each have complementary skills with making videos for people. One of the things that I learned at Mass Art was how to deal with physical film, as you were talking about.
Yeah.
I know what it's like to thread a projector. I know what it's like to scan film, which is a hidden service we offer here, by the way. If you come in with 8 and Super 8 millimeter home movies, we will gladly put them on a little USB stick for you.
Ooh, and, yes. I do see that from time to time in the Facebook world
and
other social media places.
Yeah, and Chris III himself will be carefully and with much love threading your film into that scanner.
Uh-huh.
I guarantee there will be no problems with the scan whatsoever. So, yeah, at Mass Art, I was cutting film projects on a Steenbeck. That's the old-fashioned reel-to-reel editor.
Mm.
I was cutting film projects with magnetic tape, which was outrageously expensive to get.
Yes.
And I think what was really nice about that educational experience working with the old-fashioned methods was it teaches you to really stay on target.
Yes.
Because mistakes are expensive in the film world. You have to light your film properly or else there's not an image there.
Right.
So it teaches you a level of care and craft, which is actually very portable to what we do now.
Right.
At Franklin TV, we really do pride ourselves on the technical quality of our production.
Mm-hmm.
We wear a lot of hats with the live streaming and with making sure the shots always look good, having good announcers for the sports games and things.
Certainly the love part generally comes through, but the key piece, I think, and it resonates as well with my own background to the extent that by spending time in the details of the analog world, if you will, now it's made it easier moving into this new and ever-evolving digital world.
Sure.
Let's go back to, you use an acronym, BFA, so Bachelor of Fine Arts.
I believe so, yes.
Yes.
It was BFA and film studies.
So you went to, brain cramping as to...
So I went to Mass Art.
Mass Art. Okay. So you were definitely in the art world. And then within the realm of the art world, you specifically chose BFA. Did you focus on video at the time or was it more generic?
Yeah. So I knew that I wanted to do videos and films from the get-go. In high school, I was a bit of a film rat. I thought that I knew everything just because I liked Tarantino movies, and
mm-hmm.
I could make it through a movie with subtitles on it, and it was in black and white. So I thought that I was hot stuff and that I would probably be the best filmmaker Mass Art ever saw. So
you had a bit of an education then?
I had what I thought was a lot of gusto. And what I wasn't quite prepared for going into Mass Art was the exposure to different kinds of films. So we would have a weekly, what they call film society, which
mm-hmm.
is, you know, a screening of something obscure and underground. And it would be in this dank basement with a projector.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, nobody was allowed to smoke in the building, but you could imagine a few decades before just how... You know,
yeah. the dark and smoky rooms.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. But it was cool because we would get to talk to the actual filmmakers. They would be the ones carting their movies around and they would answer questions for us. And they really ranged in topic and style. One that really stood out to me was this kind of rough around the edges, on the ground documentary about life in Myanmar, in Burma. That was a really eye-opening experience because, you know, here was this, you know, white woman that basically went there undercover with a camera to come back with people's life stories and experiences.
Right.
And that was a really cool thing. And then there were also more abstract or avant-garde films mm-hmm. that are sort of trying to tap into raw emotion. And sometimes it adds up to not knowing what you're looking at. But if you're open-minded, you can at least be charitable enough to figure out what the filmmaker is trying to express. So the movies could be challenging sometimes. So it really opened my eyes to what film was capable of outside of people's normal expectations.
Mm-hmm.
I can't say that I use much of that interest doing, you know, basketball videos for Franklin, but I think that it keeps me inspired to want to keep making videos and try to find little tiny ways to improve things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, as a film watcher, and I certainly don't have as much depth, although maybe more years, but not as much depth in terms of film history and film archives. Having started with that reel-to-reel, I certainly got involved from time to time, and even with the silent films, I struggle from time to time just trying to just take in just the film, kind of stepping into that darkness and letting them do what they're going to do so that I can experience that. And, you know, keeping the editor off the shoulder, quiet,
yeah.
quiet.
Oh, of course.
Don't figure out how they're doing it. just
right.
just experience it. You must have some of those kind of like dichotomies in terms of trying to focus on what the experience is versus, oh, I could do that better. How did they do that? Whatever.
Funny enough, you know, even though I have a knowledge of what goes on behind the scenes, I know how the sausage is made, I still let the movie just wash over me the first time I see it. I actually have some hardcore experiences with silent films at the Film Society, right? I know what it's like to sit in a basement with, you know, 15 people watching a silent movie on screen with absolutely no sound accompaniment whatsoever.
Nobody back in the
no piano.
No piano, no jukebox, yeah. whatever.
No just... canned soundtrack, just sitting there with your thoughts and other people's stomachs gurgling. and a level of tension, actually, that comes out of that.
Sure.
One of the things that's actually been fun about curating this film series at the museum is that, you know, silent film, that era lasted up until around, by 1930, it was over.
Right.
So there's been a long period since then, a good 90 or so years, where different people in different eras have put different kinds of music accompaniment onto these films.
Mm-hmm.
So occasionally I'll get stuff that's more kind of lofty, late romantic orchestral.
Okay. Yep.
Other times you get freeform jazz, which is, you know, much more discursive, and it can underscore some chaos that you're looking at on the screen.
Right.
Sometimes you get more experimental electronic synth pop stuff. Occasionally you hear, you know, sopranos singing lofty tunes.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and sometimes I would imagine, too, some of that synchronization of the audio doesn't necessarily jive with the video in some cases.
It often doesn't, but at the same time, you can understand what the sound artist is going for.
Okay.
One of the things that's really promising and fun about silent films is that, you know, sonically they're a blank canvas. They're a tabula rasa. You can
right.
do whatever you want.
Right.
When I was in film school, I actually saw a Georges Méliès movie. I think it was A Trip to the Moon, the most classic one, you
mm-hmm.
know, the one where the moon gets a rocket in its eye and cries. That film was shown to us with a really interesting sound accompaniment. It was basically carnival barkers
Ooh.
Doing this kind of crude dub or explanatory narration. You know, you know, Professor Drosselmeyer believes we can go to the moon, and then the rest of them say poo-poo. So it was bizarre to get this taste of what a traveling film might have been like in 1898
right.
or whenever.
Sure.
Because the silent film tradition is a direct outgrowth of the Magic Lantern Show. So Magic Lanterns were these antique slide projectors, And the slides themselves were these, you know, 4x4-inch glass plates.
Right.
Sometimes they would have crude mechanisms in there to do animations and what have you. But they were designed to be presented on screens with some kind of narration accompaniment. And sometimes they would be these real multi-sensory experiences with light shows going on around you. Whatever you could do with gas lamps and fog right. machines in the 1890s. So that tradition of storytelling, of showmanship, involved telling people outright what was going on. And it was cool to see a film, one of the first films, sort of adopting and evolving that form rather than just being musical accompaniment or text on the screen. Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah, it's. I think it's a real inflection point that shows you one medium sort of passing away into obscurity and another one really coming into its own.
Right. Yeah, the other one kind of in a popular film world, and I know we introduced my daughters to it when they were appropriately of age, but Singing in the Rain effectively takes that shift of, you know, the silent film actress who was always in everything, and then when it finally became the talkie, they realized that her voice was not appropriate.
Can't stand them.
And hence, they, and clearly the showman, the dancing, and everything else comes in.
Right.
And you really go deliberately as well from black and white to color
right.
in the same film. So it really, if you're not thinking about it, that's kind of the history of or encapsulated a version of history of that translation, touching on that key point in terms of going from nothing to a voice.
Of course,
the voice matters.
Right, right. And you can see different aspects of the silent film evolve as they're needed. Mm-hmm. So as I said, you know, intertitles, explanatory text or dialogue text that you see in between shots, that started off as a very utilitarian explanation to introduce the scene that you were looking at or to add some context to it. And, you know, at the bottom of the screen, you would see, you know, copyright, you know, D.W. Griffith Pictures.
Yes.
But by the 1920s, you see intertitles actually becoming a part of this kind of holistic vision.
Mm-hmm.
You look at films like The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, which is a German expressionist film related to a kind of continental European painting tradition, which was all about raw emotion. You see the style of the film with all these kind of harsh, jagged shapes and painted shadows. That all affects the way that the text is shown to you on the screen. And similarly, too, we showed Alfred Hitchcock's The Lodger, one of the first Hitchcock movies and his first real thriller.
Mm-hmm.
That film also has some really clever use of text. They actually use some light-up signs from the London skyline to kind of underscore certain points. And Alfred Hitchcock himself actually got into the film industry as a title artist.
That was his entree, his first job, so to speak.
Yeah, well, that was I think he did some clerical work in a film office on a typewriter or something, but then
he
graduated
into
setting text on titles.
Yes. Yeah. Well, that's one of the – you get your foot in the door, and then you find out what else you can do. And then if you're Johnny on the spot, it's, hey, why don't you do this?
Oh, of course. Yeah. And one thing that's really charming about the mid-1910s and before was how – small in scale, a lot of film productions were. Films were basically made by mom and pop shops where, you know, maybe your copier is also the guy that does your titles or something like that.
Right.
You don't really see this vertical integration into everybody kind of playing their part in film being a huge industry until maybe the late 1910s or so.
Right.
Yeah.
Yep. So having certainly studied, and you've extemporaneously shared some of that clearly. Other than the movies, not movies, but the like the high school sports and stuff, have you done some of your own further ventures, projects?
You mean outside of work or within Franklin TV?
Either way.
Yeah. Well, I'll start with within Franklin TV. Some of my favorite types of events to do are kind of man on the street interviews.
Okay.
So we'll cover local fairs like the Strawberry right. Stroll, anywhere where there's booths. And I have it down to a science, right? I walk up to a booth and everybody sees me with a camera. They get flustered. I say, anybody want to introduce yourselves on camera? And of course, you know, they all start pointing fingers. Oh, he does. Oh, she'll talk. And when you finally get one, you just calmly say, all I need is 15 seconds. Just tell me who you are and what you do.
Right.
And then they'll talk to me for about 3 minutes.
Sure. In some cases, you might hit the lucky spot and they'll go for more than that.
Oh, of course. Of course. Yeah. And they and I always, you know, leave the booth and they're always so grateful and so enthusiastic.
Right.
And I can tell they feel, you know, invigorated at being on camera and apparently looking so good. Because
yes.
people are really good at talking about themselves and what they do.
They are. And that's kind of that initial hurdle because even on the radio side, wait a minute, we're going to record this? People are going to listen to this? And they said, well, forget about the tech stuff. We're just going to have a conversation. Can we have a conversation?
Mm.
Yeah. I said, well, that's all we're going to do. Mm-hmm. And then just ignore the tech stuff. That's just going to record it. And then you'll get to listen to it.
Of course.
And then assuming you like it, others can.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, people thought, oh, okay, yeah, we could do this.
Sure.
So, yeah, but there is that hurdle.
Yeah, yeah. So I think that's really the spot at Franklin TV where I like to expand and play with things
mm-hmm.
is sort of that, like, outward-facing, like, social dimension where
right.
I really like telling people's stories. I think, if anything, the type of filmmaker that I am, the class of filmmaker, it's probably documentarian.
Okay.
I like finding stories. I like letting people say their piece. I'm interested in what people look like and sound like when they're saying something opinionated or when they're just really excited to tell you about themselves and what they like. And it's really sweet when you can build that trust with people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when people feel safe enough and excited enough to just let loose and tell you what they really think.
Yes.
So outside of work, right now I have an ongoing relationship with my Zen center. So I'm a Zen Buddhist. I practice at the Providence Zen Center in Cumberland, Rhode Island, and I joined their media group, which handles online promotional media. And we have an ongoing video podcast called Pointing at the Moon, which is just sort of a loose form talk show where one of the Dharma teachers talks to other Dharma teachers, some Zen masters, other people from the Sangha. And it's produced in a way very, very similar to what we do here.
Okay.
Like three camera setup with lavalier mics, and I bring some portable lights with me. I have it down, actually. It's about a 30-minute setup and a 30-minute teardown. So,
well, you've had a little bit of practice with the portable
yes,
remote studios that we developed for the sports productions.
Yeah, yeah. I actually I have a rack, a media rack, kind of similar to what we have in the studio over here. And it was actually surplus from Franklin TV. We had upgraded a rack. I think it was in the high school gym, some kind of IT rack that
okay.
Pete uses
sure.
for connections. So
yep.
there was a rack sitting around, and I said to Pete, I'm looking to do some personal work. Could I have this? And I'll fit it out myself with my own equipment. And he was happy to let me do that. So I have a nice rack, which cuts my setup time down by probably 2/3, honestly.
Sure.
Because everything's pre-wired.
Right.
And funny enough, working here, I've learned that it really is the little things that save your butt, honestly. the best equipment that you can have with you is some of the least expensive. It's tape, it's Velcro,
mm-hmm.
anything that makes your life more comfortable, keeps things where they belong. That's the equipment that will just make you say hallelujah.
Right.
It's not about having the most expensive camera with the most expensive lens. It's about having a multi-tool and a roll of tape in your pocket.
Right.
So,
yeah. Things yeah. to make sure that once you've got the record button on,
yeah, yeah,
allow you to focus within the frame
mm-hmm.
to make sure you capture what you want or
sure.
what you can
yeah.
at the time without having to worry about, is that connection going to fall apart on
you? Of course, yeah. Yeah, and with the ongoing Zen Center show, one of the things that's been nice about it is doing the same setup over and over again on location.
Yes.
And every time I do it, I'm able to maybe add something or adjust something
mm-hmm.
to make it a better experience that flows. And I'm proud to say that I think the last 4 or 5 episodes I've done with them have been pretty technically sound.
Oh, good. Oh, good. Yes. That practice to perfection, I think, is certainly something there. That once you're into it, you're doing it, it's repetitive, but then you also realize, well, maybe if I do this, maybe if I do that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you learn how to refine your process. And again, it really is the little things. You know, once you've, you know, splurged $3,000 or $4,000 on equipment, there's also learning how to actually use it, right?
Yes, it takes that practice, the comfort. Yes,
of course.
Which is why even in the studio, I bring my little cheapo device as a backup. Because your time is key. My time is key. We don't want to. We didn't pre-record this. We didn't script what we were doing.
Yeah,
it's just happening. I don't want to lose that.
Right.
Because even if we tried to redo it, it wouldn't be the same.
Of course. Of course. Yeah. Yeah.
Hence a backup. Always key for me.
Yeah. The old Cub Scout motto of being prepared, that was something that took me a long time to learn.
Mm-hmm. So if somebody, having listened to this, does want to get interested, some key tips for them, obviously just bring a desire to start with?
Of course. Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's like any other trade where you will have to, you know, get some book learning, but most of it is experience. You're going to have to work for free, I'm sorry to say. You're going to have to work for free for a little while. But once you build up enough skills and you see where all the small pitfalls are, then that $3,000 or $4,000 that you spent on your equipment will start to make a lot more sense.
Mm-hmm.
Because quality of production has very little to do, in my opinion, with the actual equipment that you have. It's more about having the basics covered and knowing how to smoothly drive over your mistakes.
Right. Yeah, for sure. And then over time, potentially there we have part-timers who help videography, et cetera. And then in those cases, you get to use this equipment.
Sure. Yeah.
So you get some real life practice with some real good fancy equipment.
That's right. You do. You do. And you understand the pressures of production, what it's like to actually manage a live stream that people are watching and that people will be dissatisfied with if it doesn't work properly.
Even in extreme circumstances.
Of course, yeah.
Especially when you're outdoor with a sporting event, if it all of a sudden starts raining, thundering, whatever.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, I kind of spoke dismissively about my customer service experience at the movie theater, but that has definitely smoothed over a few issues I've had in the field before.
Yes.
It's important to be diplomatic. One thing, too, when you take your equipment out, an important thing to remember is that you're a guest in someone else's house.
True.
You know?
You want to be respectful of their space.
Yeah.
And if you can't assume that you're just going to come in and set up. So you want to give them, at least I'm thinking what I've done is, and it's probably similar to what you would do, is just preview with the host or the guest or the owner or whatever the leader is, your contact is. This is kind of what I'm thinking.
Of course. Yeah. 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 Being honest with people. I've done projects that were promotional projects for other organizations, am willing to do projects for free just so I can get the experience of using my equipment.
Right.
And, you know, sometimes you walk up to people and say, hey, I would like to make, you know, a 5-10 minute promotional video for you, and it won't cost you anything, and they're immediately suspicious.
Yeah.
Right. But if
there's a catch there somewhere, usually.
Yeah, right. And if you're just upfront with them and say, I would like to use this to also promote myself, but the footage is ultimately yours, you have final cut. I'm not here to paint you negatively. I just want experience making this kind of work. Then people will begin to trust you. And if you're persistent, if you keep showing up, if you're diplomatic, you respect people's boundaries, then that's another key skill that you'll learn during the work for free stage.
Correct.
You know, and I think it is important to cut your own path with this sort of thing. I think there's a trap that a lot of interns fall into when they intern at organizations where they're doing it for credits or for some kind of requirement, and it's not necessarily something that they're doing of their own volition. So they show up and they want to cause as little damage as possible. That's like their number one priority.
Right.
And you sort of have to like tell them to breathe.
Relax.
Yeah. So I think that it's important to be self-directed when you're trying to get formative experience because, again, what we're doing here is a craft. It's a trade. And it's going to take some effort and it's going to take being, you know, forthright with the people that you're working with to really learn the ropes. And when you're persistent and pleasant to work with, people will be very trusting and happy that you're there.
Yeah, and I think that certainly is a key point to reference because you're going to be part of a team. You're not going to be, you know, a one-shot jockey trying to do something. You're going to have to be part of the team. So the team's production is going to be key.
Of course, yeah.
And then the output certainly is going to help build that trust over time that people are going to say, oh, well, yeah, they did this, and look what happened. It was great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So the next approach should be a little bit easier, and then the one next approach should be a little bit easier. And then after that, hopefully, people come knocking on the door and saying, hey,
yeah.
Hey.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And, you know, like a lot of things in life, having good posture is one of the most important things with engaging with the video production craft. One of the things that I notice with a lot of new people when they're doing event coverage is they'll move the camera a little bit, then they'll take their hand off the tripod, and I have to remind them, hand on the tripod, good posture.
Right? Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah, but you build that muscle memory, and you know your eye and the camera, they sort of become one. There's a follow through where you're coordinated and you're sort of becoming one with the action.
Yeah.
You know, I think that it's important to develop those intuitions if you really want to capture the full story that's in front of
mm-hmm.
you.
Yeah. And I mentioned earlier, it's once I retired and then started integrating with the aforementioned Pete, mm-hmm. you know, what I do in terms of the digital news with TV and radio. So our long-term scope is watch, listen, read. Mm-hmm. I still want to learn more of that video piece. I focused certainly on the words and creating kind of the picture in the mind, mm-hmm. but now trying to take the live pictures, mm-hmm. theoretically, or scripted pictures in
yeah.
how whatever you're trying to create, and then merging the two together. That's what you're doing.
Right, right. Yeah, at the core, it is all communication. You know, communication is verbal. It is also nonverbal. There's also context. Mm-hmm. And I think that
and outcomes, you
of
know,
course, yeah.
educational, informative, or moving in some way.
Right, right. Yeah, yeah.
Anything else you want to leave the listener with that we hadn't touched on?
Yeah, check out Providence Zen Center, 99 Pound Road, Cumberland, Rhode Island. They do public meditation instruction on Wednesday evenings and Sunday mornings, and we'd be happy to teach you how to calm that mind down.
Oh, especially in this overstimulated world of attraction. And
yes, yeah, the tricky question, how to put it all down.
Indeed. Well, thank you very much for taking some time today to share a little bit. Hopefully the listeners will be able, which Chris is that? Is that the one that talked to Steve? And you'll be the first.
Yes,
we do have the two others.
Yeah, when you call the building, ask for Levy, okay? Don't say Chris.
Levy.
Yes.
Yes. Well, thank you again. And to the listeners, quick reminder, we do this because Franklin matters. We are now producing this in collaboration with Franklin TV and Franklin Public Radio. This podcast is my public service effort for Franklin, but we can't do it alone. We can always use your help. How can you help? If you can use the information that you find here, please tell your friends and neighbors. If you don't like something here, please let me know. Through this feedback loop, we can continue to make improvements. And I thank you for listening. For additional information, please visit franklinmatters.org. If you have questions or comments, you can reach me directly at suresteve@gmail.com. The music for the intro and exit was provided by Michael Clark and the group East of Shirley. The piece is titled Ernesto Mañana, copyright Michael Clark and Tin Type Tunes in 2008, and used with their permission. I hope you enjoy. And by the way, you can also subscribe and listen to Franklin Matters Radio on your favorite podcast app. Search in podcasts for Franklin Matters.